face of it, this gorgeous violin music is relatively traditional. But the musician who created it also did this. The artist, Tina Bilberry, known as K-Tina to her fans, just released a new EP that took her outside her comfort zone. She doesn't just play violin on these recordings. She's also the composer, the producer, the vocalist. We'll hear some of the songs featuring her singing later on. The album is called Crossed Conversations. It's a very cool project, and K-Tina is here to talk with us about it. K-Tina, welcome to KCUR Central Standard.
Thank you very much.
The sound we just heard. Tell me more about it. I love it.
It's a collection of my musical experience from around the world and the training that I've received, because I was professionally trained. I am a professionally trained musician, but I've also traveled around the world and I've got to experience different cultures and different styles of music. And it kind of warmed my heart to know that there's more than just what meets the eye. And I kind of wanted to express that in my first EP.
I understand that you have also a lot of local collaborators on this recording. Can you tell me about them?
Yeah, Amado Espinoza. He's a friend of mine from Bolivia, and he's a luthier. He plays charango. He does the natural flutes. Just pretty much anything he gets his hands on. You know, he's a pretty amazing person. And I wanted to do a lullaby, so I did some research on some familiar tunes that maybe would work out with some natural instruments and or native instruments even with that. And I found I could mix some Afro-Caribbean style beats with a New Zealand tune that I kind of really liked. And I kind of put it together and I was like, Amado, can you play some flutes on this? And he was just like, okay. And so he brought his charango to the studio, and then he brought several different flutes that we, you know, sampled and figured out which ones worked best with the sound. And then I added my violin, my voice, and I asked my friend Guy Montez, who plays in the band Cucharada with me, to sing French because he's from Haiti. So I wanted to bring, you know, cross cultures into the mix. And so I've got this whole blend or fusion of different spaces and places put together in one great big or one sweet lullaby, and it's sung in three languages.
So that brings me to the name of your EP, Crossed Conversations.
Yes.
Can you tell me more about what that phrase means to you and why you named your album that?
Yeah, because I've been feels like every continent. I wanted to bring together the conversation of music because it's a universal language. So I wanted to kind of cross the genres and put them together in one place so that they communicate with each other, and so that people can see that we really are more alike than we are apart.
What's your musical background? I know that you are trained as a classical violinist,
yes,
but there are so many other influences that my ear can pick up in your music. We'll hear more, but what am I hearing? What's the story of you and what you bring to your music?
Well, like I said before, I started off with classical music, and the other side is...
At what age? I mean, is this lifelong?
Pretty much lifelong, yeah. I remember watching PBS as a little girl and looking at the orchestra on TV and like, what is that? You know, just trying to figure out what this is. Who is that? What are they playing and why? And it wasn't until my brother brought home a violin from school. And I was like, okay, I seen that on TV. What is that? And he started playing and I was just like mesmerized. And I was like, you're going to have to tell me what this is. And he was like, no, if it's not yours, you can't touch it. And I was like, come on, Patrick, just let me touch it. Just let me touch it. So he finally let me touch it. And he showed me how to play it, and I played on the A string. I'll never forget it. It's a very vivid memory, and it's my first experience with the violin, and it kind of just blew my mind, and I knew I wanted to play the instrument for the rest of my life. So from there, I went from playing, learning how to play classical music, and then because I grew up in a black church, so gospel music really had a huge influence on what I did as well. And so I kind of began to start playing hymns and just different songs from church. And then from there, cultivated into jazz. And then from there, just kind of like it was like a domino effect. And then I went on into different cultures and different styles of music. And then as I started to study abroad and travel abroad, I started to learn there's more than what meets the eye.
Tell me about those travels. You've talked about them, but what took you everywhere?
School and wanting to learn more. When I went to Jamaica, I went there as an intern, actually, a service learning internship, and I got to meet some of the local people, and I discovered that I don't like going to tourist areas because you get more of a tourist experience.
Yeah, but you get like a picture someone painted for you.
Yeah. And I wanted to know more about the culture because I was there to work with the children. So I'm like, okay, well, what can I do to learn more about the people who are native to this land? And I started interacting more with natives and just learning about their neighborhoods and going to different places that they like to hang out. And I started to respect a little bit more of who other people are in their own environment. And that kind of just opened up my mind to being a little bit more accepting of who people are and where they're from. And then I got a chance to go to Kenya, and same thing happened in Kenya. I was just like, this is amazing. Why
what
don't
took
we
you
know
to Kenya?
Another internship.
Okay, I'm taking notes.
Another internship took me to Kenya, and I was just like, this is amazing. You know, I never knew that outside of the United States, culture was so authentic, you know, because what we see on TV is not what we experience when we actually go there and live amongst the people. It's a completely mind-boggling experience. And then, I went to Argentina.
Can you give an example of something you saw in Kenya that really, like, shifted your worldview?
Yeah, okay. So it's more connected to nature. Two experiences. I was on a safari bus, and we were traveling through just wherever the safaris go. I mean, they pretty much take you everywhere. And there was this vast lands, and I was seeing the zygotes and the zebras, and I was like, wow, look at there's a lion way off in the distance, and there's elephants over here. And I was like, wow, this is really awesome. Now I can understand why they feel the earth, because they're so connected to the earth with how they live. And I started to get a sense of the beat and how the harmonies work. And I remember it started
so thinking
raining.
About Kenyan music in connection with the way you were experiencing Kenyan
mm-hmm.
culture.
Yeah, and they were playing their music, and you could hear some reggae, and I was like, reggae, that's kind of Jamaican. But they were playing all sorts of kind of music, but it was all still rooted in the same foundation. And I remember seeing rain, and I remember hearing the rhythm of the rain against the beat of the van that we were in. And I remember when our van got stuck in a mud puddle, it was just crazy, you know, how we all kind of just, you know, no matter who we were or where we came from, we still came together to come out of that pot and out of that pothole. But, you know, it sounds so insignificant, but it is significant because of how it brought us together. And so that's how my music is. I'm like, well, music can do the same thing. If a pothole can, something as simple as a pothole can bring people together, why not use music, which is the universal language anyway? Because if you can't understand the words that I say, you can understand the music that I feel. So, yeah.
So I mentioned earlier that you sing on this album.
Yes.
And one of the songs with your vocals in it is a cover of God Bless the Child.
Yes.
Before we listen to what you do with the song, is there anything you want to say about the song itself, its history? Does it mean something special to you?
It does. It's, how do I put that in words? It's something that my ancestry is rooted in, you know, and it comes from the essence of what my culture here is in America as a Black American. It speaks volumes to how we can put jazz together with the gospel and make it something completely new. And it speaks volumes to who we are as a people, and that we share it, and that we can share it and are able to share it with anybody who is willing to listen.
So the track on the EP, it sounds like a live recording.
Yeah.
Tell me about where it was performed and set the scene for us before we listen.
Well, it's a mixture of studio and live, because, you know, sometimes you kind of get a little off balance.
Yeah.
So you got to go back and fix a couple of notes. But it was actually recorded live with a small studio audience in a basement.
In the basement.
Yeah, I had a small group of people there, and we kind of just went for it.
Okay. Well, this is Katina's version of God Bless the Child from her new EP, Crossed Conversations.
Them that's got shall get, them that's not shall lose. So the Bible says, and it still is news. Yeah, mama may have and papa may have, but God bless the child that's got his own, that's got his own.
What is your singing background, Katina? I mean, specifically, you have an awesome voice. It's really full and powerful, but with this crystal clear effortlessness. Not that it's effortless to sing like that, but you make it sound that way. I don't hear you pushing the limits of your range or your volume. You're like a bird.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I started singing in the Sunshine Band at church when I was a little girl. And then kind of from there, Sunshine Band, which is a choir for little kids. And then
in Kansas City?
Kansas City, Kansas, yeah, which is where I'm from. As I got older, I started singing. My sisters and I, we created a group called Yielded Vessels, and we started singing gospel music all over, and not all over the country, but, you know, the metropolitan area. We went to different places, and from there, we kind of just started, our vocals kind of just developed over the years, and I'm not one to try and force anything, so I was like, I'll sing background. I'll let you have a front. But they were like, no, you need to come out and you need to, you know, do your own thing and make sure that you hone your craft and develop your skill. Because if it's a God-given gift, you need to develop it. And so, you know, my sisters wouldn't let me sit back and not do anything. I was like, I just play my violin. They're like, no.
I love it. Like, your brother didn't want you to touch his violin, but your sisters were like, you can't just do that. You have to sing too.
Exactly. It's like, what happened here?
Being in a big family seems to be a part of how you became the musician you are.
Actually, you're right about that. Yeah, I have seven siblings, and it's eight of us total, including myself. So it's, yeah, four boys, four girls. And it was a very interesting upbringing experience, to say the least.
Can you talk about the range of sounds that you bring together? Because, you know, we heard a little taste of the very classical sounding music you can do. And also, like, when you're bringing in your own beats and drawing on different influences. And we're going to hear next a song that does more of the original material kind of thing.
I started experimenting actually with sounds because I wanted to see what else the violin could do. So I started researching bluegrass because I had a friend in middle school who played bluegrass, and he taught me how to play this song. I have no idea what the name of it was. He never told me, but it's like da 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 da. That's the introduction. Da 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 da. He showed me how to do it, where the instruments and where we had lockers where we keep our instruments. And so he showed me how to play that. And so I was like, OK, I remember playing bluegrass when I was in middle school, and I never forgot how to play that song. So then I started trying to see if I could find it. And I came across Casey Dreesen, and he started doing this thing called the chop. I was just like, what's this? This is something new. And it actually is like this percussive sound that you do with your bow against the strings of the instrument, like really down at the last bottom 3 inches of the frog, and you get these, right? Or right? These different percussive sounds. I was just like, okay, how do you do that? So then I started studying that, and then he added a bass line. I was just like, oh, you can do a full band with this sound. So then on the piece like Talking in E Minor, you'll hear those percussive sounds in the background, and you'll hear all these tricks that are extended techniques on the violin, and you'll hear a, you know, and I mean, it's just crazy. I kind of went to town on it, and I added a bass line, boom, and I mixed a little jazz in it, and then like just went to town.
Well, the song that we're actually going to hear now is a Katina original with singing. This is On the Moon. Let's listen and then talk. Okay, so this is On the Moon by K-Tina from her new EP, Crossed Conversations, and go. So what are we hearing? Talk to me about this tune. It is very danceable.
Yeah, I've always dreamed about doing a concert on the moon. And so there was a friend of mine, Asa Barnes, who we've been talking about.
I just want to make sure everyone heard that. You want to do a concert on the moon. Go on.
Yeah, it's like a dream of mine to do a concert on the moon. And I was just like, Asa. I found a song, well, I kind of wrote a song that we can, like, do, and, like, he's really good at pop music, so it kind of all just started coming together. I was like, yeah, can you sing this? He was like, okay. And we just went into the studio, and we just started working, and it came together, and it, in essence, On the Moon.
So we've talked a lot about how you bring different sounds together, but I wonder how Kansas City is for you as a place to push those boundaries between genres and actually musical worlds. I might be wrong, but I get the impression that there's this whole world of gospel music here in town. There's a very separate world of classical music and a whole nother separate world of, like, experimental sound and experimental music. And you fuse those sounds, but are you able to fuse those worlds, like, in your life and in your work?
You know, I thought it was going to be more of a challenge than what it actually is. And I found that there's a hunger and a thirst for what I do, something that is very unique and different and just not the status quo. And I didn't realize how thirsty people are for something new, different, and tasteful at the same time.
What does this new EP mean to you on a personal level?
It's my heart. It's the heart and soul of who I am and my experience as a musician, but not just as a musician, as a person, as a mother, as a sister, as a friend, as a cousin, as an auntie, you know. It's something that I wanted to reach out to families. The biggest thing for me was that I wanted to create something that mothers would want their daughters to hear and fathers wouldn't mind their sons listening to. You know, I wanted it to be something that was tasteful and respectful so that everybody could get a piece of it and take it as their own. You know, not something that's over-sexualized or demeaning. You know, I wanted it to be specifically tasteful so that everybody could enjoy it.
Like hip and tasteful.
Yeah.
I want to play the end of a song we heard a little bit of earlier where your voice comes in at just the very end.
It's
like spoken word poetry, yeah. Basically. And you talk about yourself as the creator of this music. The song is talking in E minor, but here's the part I am talking about.
Okay. You know, I've come to a place where I can't seem to provide for the me inside. The necessity of love, truth, and accomplishment. Should I take the wide road or the road less traveled? Need to transverse this verse and get away from this curse. It's time to wake up, remove the makeup, and find the inner me that really is to be. The product of love, joy, presented musically. How I long for the day that I see the one who was, is, and is to come. For I know him, I feel him, I get tickled by the touch of him. So here we are, you and me, wrapped up in the essence of three, coming to a place where I appreciate the mind inside, express myself musically, finally in a place where I want to be. K-Tina, the past is shed, drop the mic, boom, girl. Enough said.
Ooh, explain that.
Yeah, I was in a place where I was in an emotional place. You know, we could call it that time of the month for a woman. We could. But at the end of this, I really wanted to put in a poem at the end of it. And I was just like, but I wanted to be authentic and true and just talk about the evolution of where I've come from and how far I've come to where I am today. And I thought about all the past experiences, the failures, the accomplishments, the hardships, the triumphs. And I was just like, well, yeah, you know, I do have this background. And if I'm going to be authentic to myself, I need to speak my own truth. And so that's what I did.
Is that a tension between like the violin and the rest of you in some way?
No, because I think the violin and I are one. It's more of trying to put into words what I'm feeling through my music.
Hey, Tina Bilberry, congratulations on your EP and thanks for being here today.
Thank you.
I'm Gina Kaufman. We spoke to Kay Tina when her EP Crossed Conversations first came out. That was back in August. Up next, we'll revisit a lovely conversation with Anthony from the show Queer Eye. We talked to him when he came to town with his new book. It's part cookbook, part memoir. Central Standard. We'll be right back. When the Netflix series Queer Eye came to Kansas City, the Fab Five met a guy named Wesley Hamilton. He's been in a wheelchair ever since a gunshot wound left him with a spinal cord injury, and the way he's transformed his life since that incident is amazing. Wesley's gotten over some serious depression, partly by working out a lot, but he's been limited in the kitchen.
I love to cook.
Enter Queer Eye's food expert, Anthony.
What's the thing that you're not able to do right now in the kitchen that you would love to? Like, what's the dream?
Maybe cooking more of a variety of foods. You know, food is medicine.
But it's medicine. Doesn't it make you a happier person when you eat a good meal versus like a food coma?
What I love about this clip is you can hear Anthony's enthusiasm for the food gospel he preaches. It's totally genuine and almost childlike in how unpretentious it is. If you watch Queer Eye, you know what I'm talking about. Well, for all the Anthony lovers out there, he had a new cookbook come out in the fall. It's called Anthony in the Kitchen, and it's surprisingly autobiographical. It tells a really personal life story through food. We had the chance to talk to Anthony here on KCUR's Central Standard when he was on tour with the book, and you could tell how much it mattered to him to be here. Let's listen.
I'm getting like emotional listening to Wesley's voice being in Kansas City. It's the second or third time I come back since we wrapped filming, so it's a lot of great stories that and experiences that I had here over the, I guess, almost 4 or 5 months that I lived here during filming.
Yeah, you were here
filming.
A while.
Yeah.
So would we be overstating it to say this is like your second home?
It kind of is.
I don't mean to put words
in your mouth. It's not, but it was really, you know, I'd have conversations with Tan sometimes, and whenever we film in a city, he makes fun of me because I always furnish the apartment as though it's a home, but I kind of make it a little weird and crazy. Like, I put a lot of trees and I like toys like Transformers and G.I. Joes and Star Wars figurines because I want to make it kind of like playful and fun and like I want to feel cozy. And Tan keeps it like very sterile and he's like, I'm here to work and like have awesome experiences, but like Salt Lake City is my home. And for me, I'm like, no, I have to feel comfortable wherever I am. So it's a lot of candles and trees and
Transformers.
Yeah, and Transformers. Yeah.
This book really does tell your story through food, and we'll get to the recipes, but I want to start where the book starts with a very personal reckoning, your own reckoning with crippling self-doubt in the form of imposter syndrome.
Yeah, I think it's pretty incredible. I mean, just in the few days that the book has been out, I've been kind of surprised at how many messages and like whether it's Twitter or Instagram I get of people who can relate to that. I think it's something that we've all experienced in some way, shape, or form, and continue to as well. I don't think it's something that necessarily fully goes away, but I just kind of have learned to embrace it and know that it's there, and sometimes like use it to help me strive to just constantly be learning. I'm inherently curious. I don't see that as ever ending, hopefully. But yeah, I think self-doubt comes with anything. It comes in relationships. It comes in work. Even like family dynamics. It doesn't discriminate.
That feeling of being like a kid playing dress up instead of the adult who's really doing this.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Can you though tell me like the form it took for you as you got the gig on Queer Eye, which is like great news, such exciting news.
Yes.
And then suddenly,
boom.
You're feeling.
Yeah, it came moments later. After the excitement just sort of wore off, I was left with that. It was like, you know, when you get food poisoning and you get this like chill and it's like, am I really hot or really cold? It was kind of like that sensation, minus a lot of the other things that ensue. But anyway, we're not here for TMI.
But we kind of are.
But
Go
we
on.
Kind of are. It basically like, well, Queer Eye, you know, like just the title itself. I remember when friends of mine were asking me this, what show I'd booked and why I was moving to Atlanta for a few months. And, you know, we weren't supposed to talk about it, but to best friends, I would always, like, you know, say what I was doing. And I would, like, whisper the word Queer Eye because it's still, like, I didn't feel, part of me, I think, didn't feel like I was gay enough because it was just assumed that I was 100% gay. Not that, I don't even know if anybody is, or maybe some people identify that way, but for me, I've always been more along the continuum in terms of how I identify and been in more relationships with women than men. And so that part, I kind of felt like an imposter there where it was like, oh, like, well, am I, you know, gay enough? Whatever the hell that means. Whatever the heck that means.
No, that's fine.
Okay. whatever the heck that means to be on this show. And then the second part, obviously, you know, during the audition process, there were a lot of like legit chefs. There were chefs de cuisine. There were people who went to culinary school, and like I went to university, but I studied psychology. It had nothing to do with food. So was I enough of a food person to be on the show? And some days, you know, I would wake up and be like, you know what? I am, because I'm a messenger and I'm somebody who loves to learn about food, and I don't want to be like an intimidating or imposing figure on a lot of these heroes, and I want to make it accessible and simple and easy. And then other days, I'd be hard on myself and be like, no, well, I'm not trained enough to be doing this. Like, I don't have the accreditation or whatever to have this job. And it really, but it depends like how I feel in the morning when I wake up usually. Like sometimes you feel good and other days you feel sorry for yourself. And when I feel sorry for myself, I tend to catastrophize. And then I just look at like, I find every single little thing that I can be nitpicky and critical about. And I tend to snowball.
Yeah, and you have had to deal with this in stages. There's always been, there was an article in the Washington Post that talked about this too. There's been this chatter that you've had to contend with over the simplicity of recipes that you sometimes share. And of course, you are sharing recipes not to show off your skills,
right,
but to help people learn to take care of themselves through food.
Yes.
And you know that deep down, but I'm sure that hasn't helped.
No, I mean, yeah, you're absolutely right. I think at the beginning I made a conscious effort. None of the recipes were decided until I met the hero, and it continues to be the case. Because when you meet these people, a lot of them, like, they don't remember the last time they've actually prepared a meal for themselves or anybody else. And you have to take that into account. I'm not there to intimidate them with something that they're never going to make again or that they're going to be scared of.
Or use a gadget that they don't have.
Exactly. Like, I'm there to support them and to make them feel like champions, like they're our heroes. We want to show them in their best light and get them excited about cooking. And it takes baby steps. It's like when I started, like, I messed up a lot of eggplant parm and roasted chickens and pasta dishes. And like one of the first times I boiled pasta, I remember putting regular pasta into cold water, and I didn't understand that it had to be boiling and be very salty to flavor it so that you can then use the pasta water to emulsify a sauce. Like, I didn't know any of that, and I just sort of figured it out as I went along.
I love that something as simple as boiling pasta, that you can relate to the person who is new even to that.
Of course. And I forget, too. I mean, even in the episode with Wesley, we were sitting there in this kitchen. And at one point, I smashed a garlic clove and the skin came off. And then I moved it over to the side. And I did that 3 times. And I didn't clock the fact, because I was trying not to cut my hand, I didn't clock the fact that he was staring very intently as I was doing that. And then our exec, Rachel Mendez, pulled me to the side, and we do this little trick where it's sort of like, oh, Anthony, we need to check your mic real quick, which always means like, oh, did I screw up? Did I forget to say something? Is there a point that I haven't made? And I went out into Video Village, which is the room where everyone is sort of watching. And she was like, you have to do that again and you have to explain it to him. I was like, which part? I was like, I'm going step by step with this. And I've gone through the whole methodology. She's like, no, the crushing of the garlic. I was like, oh, no, I just removed the skin. And then I made and I explained how to do the paste. She was like, yeah, but if you saw the expression on his face when he saw you just pound that garlic down with like a chef's knife and remove the skin, like, I don't think he's ever seen anybody do that in real life before. And so I went out and I was like, no, there's no way. He must have. Like, never take for granted what somebody may or may not know in the kitchen. And I went and I did it. And that was his favorite part of the entire thing.
You know what?
He was fascinated by it.
That scene also, he looked so delighted when he was trying it out for himself. Like, it was a magic trick you'd revealed.
I had so much fun with him. Like, he brought, I'm already quite child. I'm definitely a man child. But he brought out, like, that curious, excited boy in me. And I felt like he was a buddy of mine that I've been cooking with like my whole life. And it's just, I just had such a blast. Like it was sheer joy. It was like pure bliss.
The way people talk about food, and I mean, there's this term that's sort of controversial, the whole foodie thing, but people like, there is sort of a status that people sometimes feel like they can achieve by mm-hmm. having culinary knowledge or something like a social status.
Yeah.
And I wonder if that plays into this sort of dynamic that you have of like, yes, I know food, but no, that's not what I'm here to prove.
I mean, yeah, I think my goal is kind of to step back and show, look, already I have a bit of an accent. The fact that I have Polish heritage, raised in Quebec, was in West Virginia for a bit and went to a French boarding school. I pronounce things a little funny because I try to pronounce them in their language of origin. So I get made fun of by my friends for being extremely pretentious with the things that I do. When Ted Allen contacted me, because we were texting a lot during the first season of Queer Eye, he was like, what are you doing this week? And for Corey Waldrop, the cop, I made citrus supremes, where you basically remove all of the pith and all of the fiber, and you have these beautiful citrus segments that are just sort of like the flesh, with an avocado salad, which is like a traditional dish served in a lot of Italian restaurants. I definitely didn't make it up, and I wasn't the first one to ever make it. And Ted made fun of me, and he was like, oh, you pretentious bastard. He's like, you're teaching somebody how to supreme? And then lo and behold, the show comes out, and then there's like this whole other section of people who were like, that's literally, you just made avocados and grapefruit salad. Like, that's the simplest thing. Like, you couldn't go more complicated than that. No, I couldn't. Not for somebody who was too scared of his kitchen and was basically eating in his basement while his wife and daughters were eating upstairs. So it's like, you're never going to make everyone happy.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, you've mentioned some aspects of your upbringing, and I want to get into that, into your
sure.
own journey of learning about food, which is in this book. You grew up, as you mentioned, in a Polish household in Montreal.
Very Polish, I would say. It was my first language. For most of my youth, went to church every Sunday, Polish school every Saturday.
What's Polish school like?
Okay, so it was held at in NDG, an area of Montreal, where at a high school called Emily Platter. It was like super. It felt like a time machine in the 60s, with like the old Herman Millery desks that are attached to the resin chairs. It was awesome, and Pani Siwikowa, Mrs. Siwik, she was my teacher. She had a beehive and those like triangular upside down sunglasses. And she was the director of the school and my teacher. And my father showed me a photo of hers when she was his teacher. And she had the exact same hairstyle and same glasses and wore the same little two-piece suits. And she would sit there with like on the chalkboard and just basically write out Polish history. And we had to, in cursive, just copy, and she would just go and write down the board and then erase the whole board and then go like super old school. And then we would learn, basically Polish history and grammar and spelling and syntax and like how to write properly and some religion in there as well, because, you know, Catholicism runs really deep in Polish culture. But and then during the breaks we would have, oh my gosh, I just remembered something. So there was a stand. There was this boy, his parents owned a bakery called Wawel, and they made real pączki, which is like the Polish donut filled with a plum marmalade, and they're often cooked in lard and have some like candied orange skins. And I showed up one day and I didn't have money and I wanted to get a donut. And they were like, oh, don't worry about it. Like, oh, you're a Porosky. Your uncle is the board of the school and we know your dad. He comes here often. I have a really big Polish family. They're like, we'll put it on, like, we'll start a credit. So we'll start a tab. I was like, a tab? I was like 7 or 8 years old. I quickly took note of what a tab was, and I started buying donuts for all of my friends. And by the end of the semester, I think it was, like, these donuts were 25 cents, and I managed to rack up a bill of like $120 or $30. My parents were furious. And I was just buying treats for everybody because I thought, like, this is so cool. It's like free money. I can
but
just
this
buy.
Is such an early lesson in the way to someone's heart.
Totally. Well, it's also the need for everyone to love me, I guess, too. So it's a bit of a double-edged sword. Yeah.
We have to take a quick break, but we'll get right back to this conversation with Antony Perovsky, including the recipes that have a special place in his heart and his cookbook. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and you've been listening back to one of my favorite interviews from 2019, the one with Antony Perovsky, the food and wine expert on the Netflix show Queer Eye. So where we left off at the break, Antony was telling us about growing up in Montreal, and that is an incredibly international city. The school he went to had students from all over the world, and in his book, he writes about a yearly event at that school called the Buffet of Nations.
So in French, it's the Buffet des Nations. It's, I mean, most of my photos from my classrooms, we probably had about four or five white kids, and then the rest was like kids from all over. And there was this really lovely tradition where our parents would bring dishes from our respective countries, and we would sit in the cafeteria. It happened once, maybe twice a year, and everyone would just sort of break bread and share their, like, that's where I tried tadig for the first time, which is like the baked rice dish. It's an Iranian dish that I made for Ari, actually, in an episode of Queer Eye as well. And my mother would bring croquette, which are crepes filled with mushrooms, but she would make hers with wild mushrooms. And she would do,
you
like...
You guys foraged as a family.
We did.
I'm so jealous.
I loved mushroom picking when I was a kid. It was so much fun because we would... It's something we would all do together, and we would always bring our dog. We always had a miniature dachshund. And then we would come home and then roast some bone marrow, grab some really nice rye bread, and then saute some chanterelles in butter with a bit of like shallot and parsley, and then just have them on toast. And it was like the most magical thing ever. I love wild mushrooms.
I do want to talk to you about this relationship with family and food. You watched your mom cook, but you didn't join her in preparing meals. It's something you talk about regularly on the show, and it's something that appears in this book. And I'm interested in how that dynamic of like wanting to get in on the action and watching and waiting for your turn kind of shaped your relationship with cooking.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, with a lot of things that I really love, I love being a student. I love watching, and I think that is a really good way of learning. Before you jump right in, some people tend to think like, no, get your hands right into it from the beginning. But I do think that those years of observing what she did, the way she folded whipped cream and like the way she made bases for sauces and like baked goods during the holidays, I remembered all of that. I really kept it in my little memory bank. There's a lot that I forget in life. Like, I usually don't know what street I'm on or when my next appointment is. I'm like very, I can be a little ditzy with things like that. But when it comes to food memories, I remember like one of the first snacks I had as a kid, I was obsessed with bananas. I was obsessed with thinly sliced green apples with Havarti cheese. Like, that was my favorite thing when I was sick at home from school. And I loved watching her cook. And so then when I finally, you know, when I wasn't living with my parents anymore at the age of 17, I did have a little bit of a foundation. And then I just started to kind of like develop it myself. But as much as, and I do go through phases sometimes where I'm like, oh, I wish she did let me cook with her. So I feel like I could have probably learned more and we could have had some really nice experiences. But for whatever reason, I kind of ended up being the same way. And it's something that I'm trying to work on. I want to have my friends help me when I have them over for dinner. Because some of them, you know, when you have somebody over for dinner, some people genuinely want to help. And then other people
are just offering.
They're just offering. And it's like, just have a drink, sit down at the on the kitchen island and just like nosh on some cheese and like, I got this. Thank you.
I think
but some
it is
people
very,
do want to help.
It is hard to be helped in the kitchen when you have your own pace and your own rhythm that you're used to doing by
Correct.
Yourself. And you just know sort of like in your body when certain things are supposed to happen.
Right. Like, I don't want you to cut the cilantro. It's going to bruise. I want you to just take your index and your thumb and just get the leaves out and then like chop up the stems so we can use those. Don't throw them out. It's like everything is very, I'm particular.
I find it easier to cook with other people when I'm trying something new.
Oh, that's a good idea because you don't have like a preconceived sort of like set of, that's really smart.
Thanks.
I'm going to. Yeah, I think that's a good idea because that also, that's a good way to count. Like, I often will make new dishes for people. Like, you're usually not supposed to try something new out on guests and, like, do something that's been tried, tested, and true. But that's a good opportunity to try something that is neither of those things.
If the whole idea is that you're cooking together, not that you're serving them.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Well, anyway, speaking of basically, like, the dinner party type situation, mm-hmm. a stage in your own cooking journey that really has stuck with me and that feels poignant and relatable and also very particular is that you moved to the States with your dad, but your mom and sisters were still in Canada?
So those are complicated years in the history of the Porosky family and Antony specifically. So my sister stayed in Montreal. My father, my mother, and I moved to West Virginia to start junior high. And,
right, okay.
And they were still, my parents always traveled a lot. And then my mother was kind of going back and forth in between our place in Montreal and our place in West Virginia. And then my parents split up after almost 3 years of being in West Virginia. And then I moved to Montreal, but then they got back together, but I was left in Montreal. And then I moved back to West Virginia again for a year. So I moved 3 or 4 times during high school and then ended up back in Montreal again.
But this is all to say that you started throwing dinner parties at 14.
Yes. Well, they would be followed by ragers. I think it was my own definition of a dinner party. I just took it in the literal sense.
Dinner, then party.
Dinner, then party. And so I would have friends over. And like we lived on this golf course resort called Glade Springs. And when we would go to the country club, they had this awesome sandwich with, it was fried oysters with this like raspberry barbecue-y dipping sauce that I really loved. And I wanted to recreate that raspberry barbecue dipping sauce because I didn't know that you can put raspberries and barbecue sauce together and it's perfect because they're tart and acidic and sweet and it kind of works. And so I made my own version and I would marinate chicken breasts and then I would grill them on the oven when my friends would come over and they think they were coming over to just liquidate my parents' stash of Alizé and weird brown rums that they would bring from the Caribbean that no one would usually drink that they probably wouldn't even notice were gone. But they always did. I always got in trouble for it, but I kept doing it anyway. Because at that age, I didn't learn from my mistakes. But my friends were kind of shocked that it was like, oh, wait, like we're sitting down to enjoy a meal. And that was important to me. Like I wanted to have a sit down and just kind of like, there's something about the feeling of like lighting the candles, playing music, enjoying a meal with everybody. Like that's something that I remember growing up that was very, you know.
And you were recreating it with your friends while your family was in this transition.
Yes. Yeah. I missed it. I come from a really messy family and those are, like our cherished times are when we were around the table. Even if we would fight, we were all still sitting there together. To have the five of us, my two sisters, my parents and I, at a table with a dog. It was a European household, so the dog was allowed at the table. That was something that I think I've always tried to recreate. And I still continue to in some way, shape or form, whether it's the heroes on the show or, you know, with the cookbook or even having a restaurant. It's like I love creating that experience.
I love that each of these recipes represents some kind of relationship, whether it's the person who taught you to make something or the person whose taste in food inspired you to learn it. Mm. And an example of this that I really appreciated was Rima's masala nuts.
Yeah. So Rima's nuts, I love Rima's mom. She's a sweetheart. This past Mother's Day, she came over with Rima and Rima's daughter Mara, who's my goddaughter.
And Rima's a friend of yours, right?
Rima's like my best friend. We started, she was running an acting school in New York and I joined and we became very close. And we've been kind of like inseparable ever since, except we're very much separated because I've been working and filming and she's raising a daughter. There was an episode of Queer Eye there was this dish that Rima's mom would make, and it was kind of like, it's a street snack. It's something that you have. It's like my equivalent of Marcona almonds, or I have another recipe that's Marcona almonds with a bit of cheese and medjool dates wrapped in prosciutto. And like that was Rima's home's version of that. And you sort of like, there's a bit of technique in there where it's sort of soaking the red onion so that they're not as acrid, and then toasting your nuts to get all the oils out so that they get crunchy, which is very important. And learning about sort of like a spice balance. And so that was a dish that for me is like, I don't know, it makes me think of her every time. And it made it to Queer Eye, made it to the cookbook. There aren't too many Queer Eye recipes in there, but there are some that I really wanted to showcase that either didn't make final edits because we didn't have time or that I just felt were really important, where there was a nice story.
There's with this recipe and with the what you call the bastardized ramen mm-hmm. and a few others, I really appreciate too that although you are taking international inspiration, there's always an acknowledgement, and this kind of gets back to your relationship with food, not always having to position yourself as the expert with a capital E, that there's a lot of acknowledgement of where the recipe came from, where the flavors came from, and what your relationship to that is and isn't.
Totally. I think, you know, with the bastardized ramen, it's sort of like I want that flavor profile, but at the same time, I wanted a cheap way of doing it at home where I could use a lot more meat and a lot more vegetables, where it wasn't just a massive bowl of broth, because the best thing about ramen is the broth. It's the most important. But when you're doing that at home and you want to make one in 30 minutes and you've had a long day working standard 9-to-6 job, as everyone else in this world is, then it's, you know, you want something that's easy. And I know what good ramen tastes like. I've had the opportunity of trying some of the best, whether it's in Tokyo or in New York. And I just kind of wanted to make my own version of it. And, you know, with Jess, our hero in season 3, with her, she had instant ramen. I'd actually never tried instant ramen before. And so I wanted to see what that was all about. And I was like, we're not going to take her from instant ramen to basically like making her own bone broth on the first try. Like, this is already somebody who, like, you know, is intimidated by the kitchen. And so I wanted to make an easier version of it that she can share with her friends and have a potluck and ask them to bring other dishes as well. So it was a perfect fit for her, I think.
And your own heritage does come in with this pickled herring tartine recipe that I am going to have to try. Can you talk about that one, including the personal story behind it?
Yes. So I'm trying to remember what I wrote exactly in the book, but I do know my oldest sister, Carolina, is obsessed with herring. When we used to go to, I liked it as well, but I like certain kinds. She likes the more pickly vinegary ones, and I always like the creamier ones with the sour cream, which kind of seems a weird pairing, but it's very common in Scandinavia and in a lot of parts of Eastern Europe. When we used to go to IKEA as kids, there were two things that I ran towards. One was Daim, which are these like toffee chocolates, spelled D-A-I-M. Most people go for the meatballs. And the second thing was always the jarred herring. They had a lovely selection of pickled herring. Like for Christmas Eve, for example, we don't eat meat as Polish Catholic. And so we have a lot of fish. So we would have like 5 or 6 different types of pickled herring. And my sister, that's something that she would prepare. She's not much of a cook, even though she is now. That's all changed since she got married. See, we can always grow and adapt. But herring was just something that was like so beloved to her, and I just wanted to make something that was like not only the dish itself, because it can be really intense, but decided to kind of morph it into, I love a tartine. I love saying it. I love the taste of it.
I love
the fact that it's just one piece of bread and you have all the ingredients that just kind of hit your lips, so that it's not just a lot of bread and whatever is inside. I much prefer a tartine over a sandwich, and I had to have at least one in the book. And that's it.
And this is pickled herring with tart apple and shaved radishes.
Yeah, it's crunchy. It sort of gives you like all of the apples are very commonly used as well, whether you're having, I call it a dry herring, but whether it's like basically like an oily one as opposed to a creamy one. And the radishes add a really nice crunch as well.
And you love frozen peas.
I love frozen peas. I don't eat them frozen, but like I love, there's just... They may be the most nostalgic thing, because I only really started eating them. Wait, did I eat them when I was... No, I didn't eat them in elementary school because I was quite a picky eater. Or I was just a brat and didn't want to eat things that were good for me. But when I moved to New York, and I lived off probably, what, $50, $60 a week, if that, when I was in conservatory. And I had to sort of just do my best. So I discovered Trader Joe's, which had like awesome food, and they had really neat, cheap peas. And Green Giant, when they were on sale for 99 cents for the massive family bag, like I stocked up on those. And I ate a lot of canned tuna, and like frozen peas were part of that. They're ready in 4 or 5 minutes. You add some butter, some salt, get some fresh mint at the store for literally a dollar.
Yes, frozen peas are in this book.
I love frozen peas are in this book.
Yeah. Before we go, we have just a very short time, but is there something about Kansas City's food culture that you think that you as an outsider maybe can recognize and appreciate that a local perhaps doesn't?
That a local doesn't. Well, I feel like locals, let me think. I will say, as soon as we landed today, we went straight, the first place that we went to. Oh my gosh, I'm forgetting the name right now. The famous, the best pastries ever and the best croissants right on Grand Boulevard.
If you're on Grand and I'm looking at your coffee, did you go to Ibis Messenger?
Messenger, thank you. I went to Messenger every single morning. I just went there with my team who flew in here with me, and we literally had every single pastry and 2 coffee drinks. And I love everything about Kansas City. It's like, it was such a special place while we were here. I got to meet, I know we talked about Beth Barton, who's a near dear friend of mine. She is a symbol for Kansas City. She's rebellious, charming, kind, And that has been my experience. Like, those are, I feel like, the three keywords for every chef and every food person that I've met in KC while being here.
Our time is up. Antony Porofsky, thanks so much.
That flew by. Thank you so much.
We spoke to Antony back in September. He was here on tour with his book, Antony in the Kitchen, and it was just thrilling that we got that opportunity to talk. You can check out this conversation and any others you've enjoyed at kcur.org/centralstandard. That's where we archive all our past shows, and this one is our last of the year. I cannot believe it. Thank you for being part of this show. It's been so good having you in on these conversations. Talk to us on Twitter if there's something we haven't been talking about, but maybe should as we start a new year. We are at KCURCST. Central Standard is produced by Melody Rowell, Mackenzie Martin, Noah Taborda, and Sylvia Maria Gross. Thanks to all the great announcers who run the board and make us sound good every day. Our theme music is by Spoonbender Labs. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next.